leader of the Islamic Revolution, during a meeting with the people of East Azerbaijan. The meeting was held at Imam Khomeini Hosseiniyeh in commemoration of the anniversary of Tabriz Uprising of February 18, 1978.
The people chanted the same slogans, the slogan of death to America. As I said the other day, this does not mean the American nation. With this slogan, the people made an intellectual, well-informed, humanitarian, significant and meaningful move throughout the country. It is really necessary to express our gratitude. Some people are weak and inactive, and they say that the revolution has weakened. However, it is they themselves who are weak and they extend it to others. It is they themselves who have lost their heart, and as a result, they think that the people are the same. They ascribe their own weaknesses to the people. But this is not the case. The people are those whom you witnessed on the streets on the 22nd of Behman. May God show His mercy and grace on you, on the Iranian nation, and on those groups of determined individuals who defend their revolution, their government, their identity, and their country in such an insightful manner. This was the first point.
Allah, Allah.
The second point is about the dear youth who laid down their lives on the path of country's security. Well, on the face of it, the issue is that 20-30 youth were martyred, and one might argue that we have offered many martyrs, and this is no big deal, but this is a noteworthy point. This should raise our awareness about the price that we pay to ensure security. Notice that some individuals who benefit from security in their business, in their art, in their sports activities, in their education, and in all aspects of their life, show ingratitude. The security that we enjoy in our lives is achieved at this price. It is achieved at the cost of losing our youth, our best youth. May God send His greetings to the youth of Isfahan. May God's angels send their greetings to them. May God send His greetings to the martyr nurturing people of Isfahan, who organized that astonishing burial ceremony for those youth the day before yesterday.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah. Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Dark Review with me, Camelia Shambayati.
In today's show, we're discussing Abacus, Small Enough to Jail, directed by Oscar-nominated filmmaker Steve James. And joining me in the studio, we have Matthew Turner, who's a freelance film critic who writes for Vodzilla, iNews, and The List, among various other publications. And sitting next to him, we are also joined by political economist Clive Menzies, who is involved in Critical Thinking, a research and educational project which seeks to understand how the political economy works and identify levers for change. Now, this documentary centres on the Abacus Federal Savings Bank, a small American Chinese-owned family bank situated in Manhattan's Chinatown in New York City, which, because it was deemed small enough to jail rather than too big to fail, became the only financial institution to actually face criminal charges following the mortgage crisis in 2008. And born in Shanghai, Thomas Song founded Abacus Federal in 1984, hoping to make it easier for Chinese immigrants to get loans. And the bank eventually became a community hub, but in 2012, the Manhattan District Attorney's Office charged it with mortgage fraud, also indicting 19 of its former employees. And this film shows the Song family fighting back against the charges and the toll it takes on them, as well as the Chinese community.
Today, we are announcing the indictment of a federal savings bank on mortgage fraud, securities fraud, and conspiracy. A federally chartered bank that has been catering to the Chinese immigrant community since 1984.
If you are going to pick on a bank, a family-owned company, wedged between a couple of noodle shops in Chinatown, is about as easy a target as you could possibly pick.
When I was a lawyer, there was no bank owned by Chinese and serving the Chinese.
When I walk around here, I feel very much at home. This is a very tasty noodle shop.
That's always special. That's the butt.
When we were children, my dad was excited about this bank he was going to start.
We serve people who've never even dealt with the banking system before.
This whole ordeal began in 2009.
One of our loan officers stole money.
He was lying all over the place.
He was running a money laundering operation. I fired him that day.
They went straight to their regulator, and they told them about it.
The DA's office started asking us questions.
Wait a minute, maybe we're the target.
If that prosecution goes through, that bank is going to go out of business.
Although this is David versus Goliath, they're a whole family of lawyers.
We spent a lot of time investigating and ended up absolutely convinced that the loan department was corrupt through and through.
They routinely falsified mortgage documents.
Reporters in this town were treated to this extraordinary photo opportunity. This almost Stalinist-looking chain gang.
Herded like cattle down the hallway. I've been doing this for 25 years, and I'd never seen that happen.
Mommy's worried. Papa's 80 years old. He's been up since 5:30 a.m. He has nothing to eat for dinner. Let's get you some food. Papa, you do.
This is how he is. He's very calm, and I'm like a jumping bean, so I'm always running around.
You're going to eat now. You're older than a man, okay? You're not a young student.
Abacus Federal Savings Bank had one of the nation's lowest default rates, not the highest, one of the lowest. Frankly, if every bank had underwritten as well as Abacus, we wouldn't have had a financial crisis.
People get the wrong impression that Chinese are not law-abiding.
This case is an attack on our community. We're easy prey.
Too big to fail turns into small enough to jail, and Abacus is small enough to jail.
Well, very well and welcome to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. Now, this documentary, I think, gives a refreshing look at the banking crisis in that, unlike many documentaries and films in this subject, we get to see the more personal stories and the social impact the crash had. Now, Matthew, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what was your take on Abacus Small Enough to Jail?
Well, one of the most interesting things about it is we're used to seeing the big guy versus little guy stories, but the big guy is usually the bank. In this case, the little guy is the bank, and that sort of perspective, that sort of family-oriented perspective of it is very interesting. I really enjoyed the film. I thought it was a strong story, like you care deeply about the family, you get to know them very well. The director, as you said, he made Hoop Dreams, and he made the Roger Ebert documentary Life Itself, and he's very good at those sort of small, intimate family stories. And it's a very effective story, very, very well told. The court case stuff is interesting, if not perhaps quite as dramatic as you're maybe expecting. I mean, I don't think the outcome of the film is particularly in doubt, but it's still a very enjoyable, piece to watch.
And Clive, if I could turn to you, what was your take on the film? Would you agree with what Matthew said?
Yeah, I think it was a very good film as a story of itself. And I think they gave enough suggestion of this too big to fail versus small enough to jail. But to actually do that whole story justice is really two films, and maybe something like The Big Short and this together actually show you more of the picture.
And what did you make of Matthew's point that this dynamic between sort of the big guy not being the bank in this case, but the small guy?
Well, arguably the banks control the regulatory system anyway, so it's not really surprising. And our analysis would suggest that this was a targeted attempt to show that they were doing something about the crisis whilst quite willfully ignoring egregious crimes on a much larger scale.
And Matthew, as you were saying, you said that Steve James is good at telling personal family stories. In this documentary, though, it's quite politically charged. Do you think he was making a political statement?
I certainly think he was trying to. I mean, you have the the press conferences and that Cyrus Vance, the DA, gives, where he's very sort of explicitly targeting the banks, whereas actually it's the reality is it's a very small bank and nothing really related to what you'd call Wall Street. And you have the quite extraordinary the scene we just saw in the clip there with the chain gang, which is just really shocking anyway. And everybody interviewed in the film says that they've been working in this business 25 years or more and they've never seen anything like that. And the implication is they would never have done that to white bankers, black bankers, you know, anything like that.
Exonerating our entire community, no matter what we do, be it the little guy selling vegetables or a bank that's doing business. I told Mr. Song, I'm glad they pick on you because you're a fighter.
Cyrus Vance just felt this is easier to attack, especially it's a family bank. But he doesn't realize Tom is not easy to be pushed around. And my girls, they're tough, smart, capable women, so courageous.
Although this is David versus Goliath, David being Abacus Federal Savings Bank has a slingshot. And that is, you know, their whole family of lawyers.
I was going to be able to fight this.
They're almost gleeful. They're like, we're going to have our day in court now. We're actually going to be able to show that they were wrong.
They made a decision that they were not going to plead guilty to something that they didn't feel the bank was guilty of. That is a courageous choice, and it's an expensive choice. The DA's office has hundreds of lawyers and took 5 years to do their grand jury investigations, and it is a daunting task to fight the government.
You could feel the enormous weight on their shoulders and the sort of stacks that are against them. Matthew, what did you make of their efforts of the Song family to fight back?
Well, the filmmaker Steve James picks up the... I guess he's come on board the story somewhere after the court case begins and but before the result of the trial. So the cameras are actually there when the verdicts come in you get a lot of the... You're not obviously allowed cameras inside the courtroom, but there's a lot of court reconstruction, so you have a feel for how the toll that the trial itself is taking on them. And yeah, I mean, as that clip showed, they're very sort of feisty characters, and they're all three of the women are lawyers, and they're really, yeah, they're very hungry for the fight, if you like. You don't really get a sense of how the investigation is going from the other side. You only see them and their efforts to sort of fight back, and what they're doing as a family. You don't really get a sense of the DA's office. There are a couple of interviews with people who are involved in the DA's office, but they don't really tell you anything of great interest.
Mm-hmm. And Clive, would you agree, what did you make of the Song family challenges and their struggle to fight back against the DA? Do you think they were justified?
They were certainly justified. I suspect the DA were quite surprised at the strength of their fight back, because I think the Chinese community, or Chinese as a culture, are generally quite diffident and respectful of authority. And I think they hoped to actually ship them into pleading guilty, and they failed.
I mean, absolutely. There is a clip where the where Tom Sung basically he's offered a plea deal, and then they just says, no, I'm not going to take that plea deal. And it's really obvious that the DA's department thought they would just take that plea deal and, you know, all their problems would just magically go away. But no, that's they, you know, they
see this right all the way
through
the end.
Yeah, they don't take the deal, exactly. And I mean, as we say, it cost them $10 million. So another smaller business maybe wouldn't have been able to fight that the way they did.
And Clive, why was it then that, as the film claims, that Abacus was the only financial institution to actually face criminal charges following the 2008 financial crisis? You know, why don't we hear about major firms like Lehman Brothers, Bear Stearns, or Countrywide being held to account?
Could you imagine the outrage if you had Jewish bankers chained like they chained those employees? There's a very simple reason. The fraud that they're talking about in this film is nothing to do with the subprime crisis in terms of what crimes were actually committed, because the loan default rate on the Fannie Mae loans, the injured party was supposedly Fannie Mae, who made a lot of money out of this bank's loan book. And there were 9 defaults out of 3,000 mortgages. And actually, their, as it says in the film, their loan history was infinitely better than anyone else. What was happening in the subprime crisis is what people were packaging up garbage and selling it. There are stories of senior managers in Standard & Poor's, the credit rating agencies, being shouted at, being told to rate stuff, even though they didn't have the files on which to rate it. So there was this huge fraud, this creation of an illusion of some sort of quality in a mortgage book that was full of holes, unlike Abacus Bank, which had really well documented loans. Yes,
they had a case of a bad apple, but they fired the man who was giving out.
There is
bad
obviously
loans.
A cultural element to this case, which is debt is a social construct in a community. If I'm related to you and I lend you money, whether you pay me back is much less important than if I've signed a piece of paper with someone. And that is a culture of this community. And you could argue that there was fraudulent documentation, but it wasn't obscuring what was actually going on in the way it was going on in the subprime crisis, where people who were never going to be able to pay it, they didn't have cash earnings on the side that they weren't declaring. They were never going to be able to repay these loans. And the people selling those mortgages knew that, and they bet against their clients at the same time. So the criminality of the system, which controls most of the regulation as well, is actually trying to use this little bank as some sort of flag waving that we're jailing bankers. The only country to jail bankers was Iceland, and they jailed 28. Every other country capitulated. And this case had nothing to do with the subprime crisis.
Former prosecutor, I'm not soft on crime. I've never seen a spectacle like this. These people were humiliated intentionally for no good reason.
It is not the district attorney's office's decision whether or not to put people in handcuffs, but people who were brought into court who have been charged with crimes are put into handcuffs. That's a decision that's made by the court officers. I won't go into it more than that because, you know, it's not something I'm involved with.
So in the film, we learn that the Abacus Bank plays an important role in the Chinese community. And we also find that it provides mortgages to immigrants who live sort of in a cash economy and have hidden assets. And we also learn more about Thomas Sung and his character in this film and his intentions, his noble intentions in starting the bank, as he believes that Chinese immigrants were being left out of the American dream. And what did you make of his character and his story?
Well, the film explicitly uses clips from Frank Capra's It's a Wonderful Life. The opening shot of the movie is Thomas Sung and his wife watching it and identifying very strongly with James Stewart's character, George Bailey. And particularly his position within the sort of small town community, what feels like a small town community, and helping people with small businesses, and he knows all the businesses, everybody knows who he is, and stuff like that. So there is very much that sort of man of the people element to Thomas Sung's story, I think.
And there's a scene in the documentary where we see that he's able to calm the crowds of all the clients who are rushing to get their money back, and he's able to soothe them.
Exactly like happens in It's a Wonderful Life. And in fact, the film shows clips of that exact same scene happening. It shows clips of George Bailey speaking to the crowd, preventing a run on the bank by telling them that your money's in his business and your money's in his business, and everybody's kind of helping each other. And you don't actually see Sung calming his own crowd, but he tells you, you have him telling the audience what he actually did, which is basically exactly the same thing. He went out and told everyone, calm down, you know, trust me, you know me, I'm here, you know, your money's safe, and it worked.
It was an uncanny moment. Scene, actually, yes, yeah. Absolutely. And Clive, the film shows and suggests that there were racial implications behind the charges. Why were they being singled out? Was it because they were Chinese?
I don't think it was racist in the sense that the Chinese are dishonest. I think it was the Chinese were seen as a soft touch. As Matthew said, you know, they were visibly shocked when they wouldn't cave and plead for guilty. Mm-hmm. They preferred to fight. And I think that was their undoing. Other than that, I don't think it was racist as such as demonising a community, but clearly it had that effect. And it's interesting, Matthew talked about It's a Wonderful Life, and banking is an inherently dishonest business, which I won't go into. But what has been banking's salvation over the years is the relationships, and that's what banking always used to be based on. But that has completely gone with these mega banks, so there is no relationship. So you are dependent on the forms, whereas in a bank like Abacus, you're dependent on the relationships, and that's what their business is. And that's in stark contrast to what was going on elsewhere and being ignored.
That's a really interesting point. Did you want to add anything to that, Matthew?
There was, on the racism element, there is a very telling comment from, I think it's the DA, correct me if I'm wrong, but where he says, oh, well, no, of course we weren't racist. We didn't treat them any differently to the way we treat South American bankers or, you know, Russian bankers, or what, you know, he sort of lists another
other ethnic
groups, yeah, but leaves one kind of fairly major group out, white bankers, and that's the kind of fairness you'd at least expect.
I never thought my girls would work in Chinatown because we lived in Greenwich, Connecticut. Tom would be commuting every day, you know, like an hour and a half each way, so he didn't see them that much in those days. They had no idea anything, not a faintest idea about the Chinese community. In fact, Heather still doesn't. She hates the city, you know. She's like me, we both have headaches. And at home, when we don't want them to understand, we speak Chinese.
You always said to me, if you come work for the bank, the benefit will be you have a 9-to-4 job.
9-to-4?
Yeah, because a long time ago, people could leave at 3 for the bank. He said, you can have children, you can have a family.
You know what he said to me? He said, if you wish to work with me, remember, this is your own choice. And don't think it's going to be easy. You gave me two different stories.
They're very endearing, warm family, and it makes you wonder if any other bank CEOs are this caring. And Matthew, I just wanted to ask for your brief views on the family themselves and how they're portrayed.
I think they're great. I mean, they're very entertaining dynamic between certainly the daughters and the mother. Well, the mother's the real star of the movie, in my opinion. And she sort of undercuts all of them with quite sort of funny comments. There's a whole sequence, a whole bizarre sequence where they're all sort of stressing about the sandwich that the father is eating and whether it's too dry and is he enjoying it and is he sure he's enjoying it and all that sort of stuff. Yeah, you get a
real feel. But then it just highlights the unfairness of the situation, that there's an old man enduring this ordeal.
Yeah, he's 80. He's 75 when the prosecution begins, and he's 80 when it finishes. Although I have to say, he looks pretty damn good for 80.
Yeah, not bad at all. And Clive, I'd like to talk about the wider issues now of the film. Why isn't there, I get the sense of this theme in the film, that there's a lack of accountability in the banking world. What do you make of this?
If you look at the personalities and the structures, they're all related. So the banks, in effect, control the central banks, they control the regulators, and so what appears to be wrongdoing can always be covered up. So you take the example of HSBC money laundering. They confessed. So the Department of Justice had a cast iron case. They were lent on by a combination of George Osborne, Adair Turner, and Mark Carney, Chancellor of the Bank of England, head of the FSA at the time and Chancellor of the Exchequer, they all sit on the Bank of International Settlements board. So there is this web of power that sits over the financial system that actually ensures its own survival. That's why they bullied Congress into bailing out the banks in 2008, because they control the
levers of power. And we saw this in our country as well. Why is there such a tight relationship between the banks and the government? Aren't the banks supposed to serve the people?
Well, it comes back to that Rothschild quote, that let me control the nation's money supply, and I care not about its laws. Simply, money gives you control, particularly when you can create that money from nothing. So you can buy politicians, you can bribe politicians, you can pay people to kill politicians. So what's a politician got to do? He's got to obey orders.
There's some very hot issues you raise. But does this film evoke these sort of wider questions and raise issues about the morality of banking? Did you get that sense also from watching this documentary?
In this particular story, it's more focused on this small family and their small bank, and how, as Clive said, that this what happens to the Sung family is not related to the wider financial crisis. It's not the same, you know, the same thing. So in that sense, no. But you are very much aware of the financial crisis in the background, and certainly, like I said, the press conference that Cyrus Vance gives, where he gives this very sort of ebullient statement about, well, yes, we're going to be jailing these bank effect. Well, words to the effect of, we're going to be jailing these bankers, without really going into the detail. Yeah, certainly that's there.
Well, certainly we learn that they emerge victoriously from this, the Sung family.
Spoiler, but yes.
Yes, a little spoiler, but I think it's public knowledge sort of now that this court case has gone on. But just final thoughts now. Matthew, what's your verdict on this film, and would you recommend it?
I would certainly recommend it. It's a very entertaining story. Yeah, it makes you angry a little bit, and it's, you know, it's always interesting to see film documentaries where there's a sort of strong sense of injustice, and particularly if it ends well, then that's, you know, all for the better. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I enjoyed it, certainly.
And final thoughts to you also, Clive. Would you recommend this documentary?
I certainly would. What spoke volumes to me is that Ken Yu, the DA star witness, was the original fraudster that was reported by the bank to the authorities, and they revoked his plea bargain at the end and charged him. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that tells you exactly what was going on.
I'm afraid we'll have to leave it there, but just quickly.
I just wanted to add to that, actually, that really stuck out for me as well. Like, not only that, the original fraudster becomes the prosecution's star witness, which is just insane. I really couldn't understand that at all, like how that was allowed to happen. Basically, somebody who has confessed to lying and been caught lying and committing fraud becomes the star witness. Mm-hmm.
It's a very puzzling business indeed, but I'm afraid we'll have to leave it there, and we've come to the end of this episode of Doc Review. Thank you to both my guests and to you. I've been Kavita Shambayati, and see you on the next episode of Doc Review.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com, Facebook.com/EN.
The debate.
Hello and welcome to Debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, in November of last year, a controversial bill was drafted in France which would prevent journalists from filming police during arrests. Now, people have regularly taken to the streets in Paris and other cities to demand that the law does not come into effect this January. Will protesters be able to keep this from becoming law, and what they say would take away the checks and balances to help prevent police abuse and brutality? Stay with us as we take a look at all of this on this debate.
Protesters have taken to the streets in dozens of French cities against a security bill they say will restrict the filming and publicizing of images of police brutality. Demonstrators said the draft legislation will lead to more censorship and less freedom.
This bill has one objective, to allow a surveillance of the territory by drones. We are, of course, against the ban for journalists to film and to publish pictures of police officers. They want to prevent the publication of footage of police violence. The citizens say we don't want this law at all.
A total of 70 groups, including the Yellow Vests, organized the protest. Protesters said the new law opens the door to a generalized surveillance of the population, the use of drones, and the ban to film police officers.
French people have been the victim of police violence for a long time, in the suburbs more than elsewhere. There is more and more violence during demonstrations. The citizens should understand that we are here to defend their future liberty and the right to film. We must be able to show the judges that sometimes there is police violence. Pictures are sometimes the only evidence.
Footage of white police officers beating up a black music producer in his Paris studio on November 21 has fueled anger over the legislation, condemned by many as signaling a swing to the right by President Emmanuel Macron.
We've got for a lot of years now in France a lot of discussions about identity checks, which are very more likely to be happening to young people, to men, and to men with different backgrounds from origin, Arabic people and black people. So this kind of systematic background checks and identity checks, it participates to a state racism in French, especially about the police, and so we are fully supporting the Amnesty report.
Last week, Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, and four other rights groups warned that they will file a lawsuit against the French government for what they called systematic discrimination by police officers carrying out identity checks. Even French President Macron admitted recently that there was a problem of discrimination during identity checks.
The new security bill will be debated in the French Senate in about 1 month. Some senators declared they want to rewrite the bill, but most protesters here simply want to abrogate it. Chris Den Hunt, Paris.
I'd like to welcome my guest to the program out of New York, journalist and author Daniel Lazar, and out of London from the Islamic Human Rights Commission, Raza Kazem. Thank you both for being with us. Well, let's start it off in New York. And Daniel, I mean, why do you think the French government has proposed such a law at this time?
Macron is under great pressure from the far right, from the National Front of Marine Le Pen. In order to hold her off, he's adopted a policy of trying to co-opt her program by toughening up the police and toughening up state responses to protests and demonstrators, and using generally more punitive measures. I mean, France is feeling the strain of COVID, the pandemic, and a severe, savage economic contraction. Tempers are rubbed raw, conflict is rising, and the state feels it has no choice but to respond in a militant manner, and that's the only way Macron knows to hold off the challenge from those even further to the right.
Well, what about that, Reza? I mean, Daniel said tempers right now are raw, it's sensitive, they're under a lot of pressure, but as a matter of fact, isn't that even more of a reason to make sure that there are checks and balances on things in France?
I think one of the things that is happening with this particular law is this whole idea of making sure that any police brutality that's carried out is not going to be filmed. And this is particularly something that is conducive or signals that what we're seeing is the emergence of a police state and the different powers that it actually has as a result of it. Because if you don't, on the other hand, we've seen also that many police authorities, police people on the streets and on the front lines are actually carrying cameras and so on in which they can film what's actually going on. And this allows for making sure for there to be accountability. What we're seeing with this is that accountability will be selectively chosen, and where needed, evidence can be disposed of by the police officers if need be. And in this particular case, what we're talking about is a serious infringement on rights. It's not just about the fact that it's there's a lot of pressure and so on. We've seen this kind of deliberate move over years and decades in this direction. What we're seeing also is that this is something that is very much reminiscent of what used to happen and what was certainly talked about in terms of happening in the Soviet Union spheres of influence, in particular the Stasi police state of East Germany. And so what we're seeing is very much a reemergence of some of those ideas and some of those natural things being put in place. Mm-hmm. And it's got a label of democracy on top of it to try and sweeten what is actually being done. So I think there are some serious issues that are there, and France needs to be called out for what it is, that it is going in the direction of a police state. And that's what it's about.
Well, Daniel, I mean, during this period of grave dissatisfaction of the French people towards their government, doesn't this type of law simply make the Macron government even less popular than it already is? I know you talked about trying to appeal to the far right and Le Pen and those who follow her, but in general, as far as looking at the overall French electorate, couldn't this be dangerous for the government itself?
It certainly could be, yes, but I think that Macron believes he has more to gain than to lose through this kind of policy. He's trying to appeal to the conservative part of the French electorate, which is fed up with disorders in the streets, wants a tougher police response. And if it doesn't get it from Macron, it'll turn to the National Front and Marine Le Pen. So that's the game Macron is playing. He's trying to carve out a base for himself in an angry right of center electorate, and he's hoping to succeed. So we'll see what happens. But unfortunately, if Macron loses, we could very easily see power slip into the hands of the National Front, and that would be, of course, an even greater disaster. Not that I'm trying to make excuses for Macron or in any way justify his policies, because I'm not.
Okay. Well, Reza, immediately following the proposal of this law. Back in November, a video went viral in France showing a black music producer being brutalized by French police. Do you think that this has played any role in getting more people on the streets to protest against this law? And what could have happened in that same case if there had not been any film of the situation?
I think to answer your first question, it's quite clear that in any kind of law enforcement situation where there is no evidence to suggest and there's no one from within the police who were involved in that process of brutalizing an individual that they are seeking to arrest or seeking to question or whatever, then the police inevitably have backed each other's stance or have gone quiet and not said anything against their own colleague in terms of the repercussions they might have within the policing fraternity and their careers and so on. So this is something that needs to be understood, that this is something that is very much there. And in terms of the problems within this, with this actually being filmed in terms of happening to a black individual, I think the problem that the people are seeing, that once this goes out, that with any kind of injustice that is going to be coming into the forefront and going to be legislated in this way, then inevitably things that are targeted at minorities, be they Arab or black or whatever, in this case, the instance you're talking about is a black individual being targeted in this way. What people here have recognized from the white community in France is that this could be something that will give police powers that are beyond something that they are prepared to accept. But we need to understand the racial element that exists within this context, and in particular within the context of France. We're talking about a country that is deeply racist in terms of its attitudes towards people, institutionally racist in many of its institutions, and that's something that is put out there, and it's something that comes up every regularly in terms of how that institutional racism is also impacting on the racist attitudes of ordinary people in the country. And I think that's something that needs to be recognized and said for what it is, that is what the problem is and that is what's going on. So there is different layers, if you like, to that.
Well, Daniel, in your perspective, how common is police brutality in France anyway?
It's very hard to answer that kind of question because evidence is very hard to obtain. There's a code of silence among police officers, and very often a criminal case boils down to individual cop's word against an individual defendant's word. So it's difficult to prove, and it's difficult to know. It's kind of the phenomenon is kind of in a black box.
With that being said, I mean, wouldn't the government know to begin with that there's definitely going to be backlash in suggesting something like that that would not be in the benefit of the average citizen?
Well, because the government thinks that maybe in balance it'll be politically beneficial to the government. That, in other words, that more citizens will approve of this policy than disapprove of this policy. Yes, a certain vocal element is taken to the street, in my opinion, to protest this move towards police authoritarianism, but they're not the entire electorate. And so therefore, some portion of the electorate may approve of these measures, may approve of a tougher police response. That is Macron's gamble. That's what he's trying to do. So we don't know how it will play out. Certainly in the United States, police violence is a massive problem, completely out of control, many people are up in arms over it, but many people support a tougher police response. So this is what the political struggle is all about.
Indeed. Well, Raza, there have been growing complaints by many French of increasing surveillance by security forces in the country. Why is it, on the one hand, the government increases surveillance techniques against the people, and on the other hand, Paris doesn't want journalists to keep watch over police?
think in terms of the direction that they want to go in, that they want that surveillance to be something that they can use and weaponize for their own political ends. It's not about something where the police should be a force, an institution that actually works for the community in terms of making sure that policing takes place in a sensible and a way that brings confidence into the community. But when the state goes about these kind of things, where they increase surveillance, where they reduce the ability of the ordinary citizen to challenge the police, even by filming some brutality or whatever that might be taking place, then what you're doing is increasing, as I said before, the idea of creating a police state and continuing down that route. And when we talk about one of the three phrases that is often associated with France, and it's something that is very much part of the publicity relations exercise that France carries out internationally about liberté, as it calls it, it's quite, you know, I think it's a bit of a joke that they dare to say that about anything that happens in any other country around the world in terms of policing, considering the direction that they're actually going in. And I think that one of the first things that needs to be said about this, that France is a police state. It's not about liberté, fraternité, et cetera, et cetera. It is about reducing the rights of individuals and citizens. And in answer to your question, it's about weaponizing surveillance and for it to be used as a tool when it suits the French political establishment, whichever strand of it may well be interested in a particular direction that it wants to go in. And so it's all part of those same machinations.
Daniel, your take on what Reza just said, I mean, because, yes, France likes to brag about its democratic roots and having liberty for all of its citizens. Has it simply become a slogan with the reality being something very far from the truth?
Unquestionably. I mean, yes. I mean, that's the story for much of modern French history. But yeah, I mean, France as a country, it's a large urban country with a swelling underclass, many of them immigrants or racial minorities. There's crime. There's a war on drugs, whose impact in terms of undermining civil liberties can't be underestimated, can't be overestimated. I mean, France is subject to the same authoritarian tendencies of every other advanced industrial state on Earth, including the U.S., Britain, Germany, etc. And they, all of them, are drifting in a more and more overt authoritarian direction as the social crisis, the economic crisis, intensifies. And that crisis is already acute. I think it's going to get worse and worse in the coming period. And these governments are responding by unleashing the police, adopting more punitive measures, and that seems to be the direction that they are heading in.
Reza, your take, same question. Do you think that, what's the reasons in your perspective that countries like France is going towards a more authoritarian way?
Yeah, I mean, if we come across from France, across the English Channel, and come to Britain itself, we need to understand that what was pejoratively, derogatively looked at institutionally in terms of what the police had actually done in terms of infiltrating and abusing the communities and so on, in the way that surveillance was actually carried out, in the way that abuses took place within that policing context, what we are now seeing is that police are being asked and told that they will be protected under law by laws being passed which will allow them to carry out these actions, and they'll be protected. So it's one law that will be applied to the police, there'll be another law that will be applied to the ordinary person. And what we are seeing is that as this direction actually continues, the idea of more and more countries and more ideas of the police state being entrenched in different sections of the law, the establishment, the institution, the more problems ordinary people are actually going to have. It's going to start off by targeting racial minorities. It will start off by targeting people who are, who have some kind of communities that are disadvantaged and so on. And inevitably, as it happens with, and there are plenty of examples, going back to the terrorism laws and so on that were started at the beginning of this century in the UK, which have gone on to target ordinary people, the wider white community. And this is something that is very much going to be happening here. And this culture stems from this idea that the end justifies the means. The principles are not even being paid lip service to, that philosophy is not something that is acceptable.
Daniel, do you think at the end of the day that this law is going to be implemented? Because as we're saying, there has been a lot of blowback, but as you also said, there are those who actually support it. So your assessment at the end of the day, will it pass or not?
My assessment is that it will pass, that Macron thinks it's very important. Macron thinks he's got to show that he has a strong hand, that he will not be cowed, that he's resolute, and that he is he's determined to hold off a challenge from the radical right. So I think in the end it will become law.
And Reza, your prognosis, near future of France, we're going to see a continual deterioration of rights for citizens and others?
I think that's inevitable. I think that's, if you chart it, before the idea was that the concept of liberty and so on was actually talked about and brandished about around the world, it's something that is being done in France to actually keep on emphasizing these concepts and so on. But actually what has been going on, if you chart the history, and it's just not just in France, it's happening in Britain as well in terms of what the rights are going to be, what people can and can't do, and how the spaces in which people can actually express themselves and have legitimate freedoms to actually be able to express discontent and to be able to protest, all of those things are being squeezed so that the net effect is the reduction of people to be able to say something. And that is very much reminiscent of a police state and fascism. And I think, unfortunately, while they might call it democracies, that's the direction that things are actually going in.
And it seems, unfortunately, history continues to repeat itself. On that note, I appreciate both of you being with us. Daniel Lazar out of New York, journalist and author, and Reza Kazem from the Islamic Human Rights Commission out of London. Appreciate you both being with us. And as always, nice to have you with us on another debate.
This is the voice of the Islam.